Morning, Rabbi Isai. Our limud of halacha every day is as a schus for the refuah of Yosef Dov Ben Chayle, Shtav Refuah Shlema, Bekor, B'Sosha, and Chayle Yisrael. So we started yesterday, we're looking at four scenarios as to whether or not you do or don't have, well, you have to have some bread on the table, but the question is what you bring and how you bring. So we started off yesterday saying that if there is no bread on the table, so I gave the example, you're eating your sandwiches, you're eating your lunch at your desk, and there is no other bread on the table, you finished everything that you brought, and there's no other bread on the table, then the halacha would be that you need to bring a bread onto the table. In order that, you mekayim the three targets that we want to achieve. Target number one is that we indicate what we're thanking our Kodesh Bochel for. Otherwise, when we're benching, somebody walks in, he could see that you're sitting there amongst all your papers and your files and your computer, but there's no bread there. So he thinks you're saying tell him or whatever, you could be davening mincha, saying kobonos, well, who knows what. That's number one. The second thing is shemo yovoi oni. So therefore, I need to have some bread on the table in case somebody walks in and he's desperate for a meal. And the third target was in order to, that the brocha should be chal. I've got food on the table, therefore the brocha will be chal on the food and it will be misraba. So those are the three targets that we've got. So if there's no bread on the table, then I need to bring. What do I bring? I can either bring psisim, I can either bring pieces of bread which are more than a kazayis, or I can bring a shlemo. I can bring a shlemo. But what we learned yesterday was that if I have psisim on the table, then I don't bring a shlemo. Because that looks like, if you've got psisim, you've got a few, let's say you've got three slices of bread, or a box of matzahs on the table, then there's no point in bringing a shlemo. Why would you bring a shlemo as well? You're mekayim all three targets, all the three achievements that we want, you're mekayim already with the three pieces of bread that are there. And therefore, you can't bring a shlemo. Why? Because then it looks like it's a takrovis avodah zorah. That was the posuk that was brought down in halacha that says that I've forgotten what was the posuk. The name I've forgotten already. Yeah, but the posuk which says that I'll find it in a minute. That it looks like avodah zorah. So that's scenario number one. By the way, if it's the other way around, if you've got a shlemo on the table, you can bring psisim if you want, but there's no point. But if you've got psisim on the table, then you shouldn't bring the shlemo. Then the second case we said was if there are psisim and no sholem. So that's what we just said. That's the second case. I've achieved everything I want with the three pieces. Therefore, there's no point in bringing a sholem, and that looks like avodah zorah. What happens if the other way around? There is a sholem on the table, but I don't have any psisim. So, in other words, I've eaten my meal, and there's a whole challah left over on the table. So I achieve everything. I've got bread for the oni, I've got something for the brocha to be chalon, and I'm showing that when I'm davening with the bread on the table, it looks like I'm davening to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the mozen shel chalnu, and therefore you're mekayim everything, no problem at all. Funny, not funny, but an interesting thing it says here, that it says, V'hanoigim l'hashir sholem ala shulchan kol halaylo. There's some people apparently who had a minhag that they would leave a lechem sholem on the table all night long, right throughout the night till tomorrow morning. Yesh limchois, says the Levush, one should do so, because it's mechse ka avodah zorah. It seems to be that maybe there was a... It's the idea that we said that when we go into, sometimes we go to a Buddhist house or something, and there was a shrine there, and there is a food that's offered to the shrine. So this is the same sort of idea, that if you're going to leave the bread on the table all night long, then it looks like it's some sort of a takrovis avodah zorah. Yeah, and therefore, says the Be'er Heitev, yeah, the Be'er Heitev argues, and the Be'er Heitev says the opposite. The Levush says you have to take it away because it's mechza avodah zorah. The Be'er Heitev brings down, ve'ein sorich lohosi ashleimo mishom. Yeah, and it's not nearer kilavoy dezora. He doesn't agree, so therefore it's a machlokes as to whether or not there seems to have been a minhag once that people left a sholem on the table all night long, and it's a machlokes whether or not there's a chashash of nearer kilavoy dezora or not. Now, what happens if As I said, so we said if there is a sholem and no pesisim, then there's no need to bring pesisim. But if you want, you can. You can add pesisim to the sholem if you like. So, I mean, in practical terms, hypothetically, people who eat lunch at their desk should really have some reserve bread or box of matzahs or something that they can leave on the table during benching if they're going to finish off all their sandwiches. Right? If they're going to finish off all the food and there's not going to be any food on the table at that time, or in general terms, if you're sitting at a table and you finished off all the bread, then... Now, if there's other food on the table besides the bread, not there isn't bread on the table, there's other food, yeah, then hypothetically I've also achieved my aims, i.e. I've got food on which the brocha can be chal, I've got something to offer the oni if he turns up, and I'm showing what I'm thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for. I didn't see anywhere in what so far in Shulchan Aruch and in the Mefoshim of Shulchan Aruch in Simon Kuf Pei that we're learning at the moment, and also in the Sefer Shmiras HaNefesh, HaGuf HaNefesh, where he brings down these sort of halachas, it doesn't say anywhere what happens if you leave other food on the table. But l'choira, in order to achieve our three targets, in order to achieve our three aims, leaving other food on the table, having an apple on the table, why does it have to be bread dafka? I know lechem is sort of staple diet, and it represents food, and it represents unoisin lechem l'chol basar, but I think l'choira, I'm just saying that l'choira, if you haven't got a box of matzahs to put on the table, then you should put any other food that's on the table. Will all do. Okay. Now, final case would be if I've got pesisim and a sholem. So I finished my meal and I've got a challah that's unstarted. In addition to the challah that's unstarted, there is also a bowl with sliced bread in it, with sliced challah from the previous challah. So now I've got sholem and pesisim. Says the Mishnah Berurah, b'shem the prima godim, lo yasher pesisim im yesh shleimo. Yeah. Then you shouldn't leave the pesisim on the table if you've got a sholem. So if there's a whole challah there, then you should remove the pesisim. I'm not sure why. And the only thing that I could think of was, it could be Alpi Kabbalah, and that's the easy way out. Alpi Svara, it could be that you should rather be Mechabed the Oni if he comes with the Sholem. Yeah? So it could be that rather than give him sliced, or rather than give him pieces of something, rather give him a Sholem.
I need a Sholem for Shabbat Shidus.
Yeah. Then
if I need
the sholem for the next meal, then I've added the pesisim are good enough. We said that if you've got pesisim on the table, if you've got pieces of challah, pieces of bread which are more than a kazayis, then we said that's good enough. So therefore, yes, if you leave the pesisim on the table, you can remove the sholem. The Mishnah Berurah then brings the b'shem the taz she'ein sorich lahosse pesisim al shulchan kishiyesh. Shleimo, he says, and he says, but Shabbos, for some reason, on Shabbos, vaday lo yosir lo psisim v'lo sholem adach apichas hamozon. So the Mishnah Berurah says clearly, b'shem the Taz, that although the Prima Godim says that you don't need to remove, that you shouldn't leave the psisim if you've got a sholem. But he says that he brings down b'shem the Taz. There's no reason, if you've got sholem and you've got pesisim, you can leave them both on the table. And he says especially on a Shabbos. So that's basically those are the four scenarios. If you think about the three targets, if you think about the three aims that we have of number one, that we want the food to be, we want the brocha to be chal on food which is in front of us. We want it to be nikah, that I'm benching in order to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the third target was that I should have some food available for an onish yovoi. Then if you think of those three targets, then you can paskin yourself. Once you know the three principles, then in each situation, whether you've got psisim, or whether you've got shlemo, whether you've got neither, whether you've got both, it's quite easy to work out what you should do.
Start the other Torahway, Northwest London, Friday, Kof Dalad 7, 20th of June. Renarab Rav Rashi Simon Shlita, as grasshoppers in our eyes. This week's Torah is sponsored by Fanny Ratz's Dorfer, Lippur Simon Sabah Mitzvah of Eli Ratz's Dorfer, tomorrow, and Mr. Shemahi Rotzin Shkavarov, Rukhina Rav Nachas, Mimen Vachayat Seif, Vatahem Vesus, Hashavim Vachayalim Vachayalim, Bamil Chamosh, Vatsul Vatahem, Shalom Bimheirov.
Amen. Thank you, and good morning. Sorry for my slight lateness due to parking challenges. Our subject this morning, we heard already from Irani, grasshoppers in our eyes. Of course, the turn of phrase comes from the report of the Meraglim, and actually, the observation or the contention that we were as grasshoppers in their eyes is only speculative. How did they know, how did the Meraglim know how the Canaanim viewed them? Now, the imagery is clear. It says that we went to the land and it consumes its inhabitants. The people we saw there were of huge anshe midos. Doesn't mean bale midos. It means they were of huge proportions. V'shamreinu sanefilim. And then they mention the, again, by way of describing how enormous they were, nefilim b'nei anak, the sons of the giant. V'nehi b'eineinu k'chagavim. And we were in our eyes as grasshoppers. V'chein hayinu b'eineihem. The point is that they were so much larger than us that they kind of imagined they could just trample upon us. Rashi says that we heard them talking, yeah, what are these little creatures scampering around in the meadow or something like that, because they're so much larger than us. Of course, there may be some hyperbole here, but we have to wonder, why does the Torah say, V'nehi be'eineinu k'chagavim, we were in our eyes as chagavim. So there's a fascinating passage in the writings of Rav Dessler, Michtam Eliyahu. It's in the first Chelek. And he advances two paradigms of the perception of the Jew in exile. He says, "Bezeh tamun hasod shagalus me'olam lo pagma benefesh klal Yisrael." In this is latent the secret of how the experience of exile historically never undermined the self-respect of the Jew. Even though we were marginalized, we were demonized, we were persecuted, we were regarded by our enemies as inferior, but we never internalized their caricature of us. It never undermined our own sense of self-worth. On the contrary, even though they found it necessary to adopt a kind of obsequious posture in order to survive, in order to find a way, a kind of survival technique, but it never undermined their own sense of self-worth. He says, "Betoch libam ruv matzavam rak gzeras hamakom." In their hearts, they saw their circumstances simply as part of the divine decree. V'lo yosa ha'oivim matzavam shvelim v'nivzim hayu be'enehem. The enemies, those who their captors, they regard the Yidden regarded them with disdain. The fact that they, the nations of the world, heaped contumely upon us, we never internalized it. We regarded them with, as I say, with disdain, and the Yidden always recognized the superiority of the Torah, the superiority of their way of life, and the fact that, unfortunately, we were, as I said, disadvantaged, they were prepared to accept it as part of the divine decree. I'm not saying they were happy with it. He doesn't say they delighted in it, but it never, as I said, undermined their own sense of self-worth. He says, "V'asonim lo hitzlichu af pam lehafchis etzal hayudim es hakaras ha'erech ha'atzmi hapnimi shalahem." Their internal sense of self-worth. He said that was in the good old days. Kach haya b'doros harishonim. Ach b'doros ha'achronim, but in later years, in later generations, k'shenismatu ha'levavos ul'umazos gadal erech ha'oivim be'einenu. We have an irony, a sad irony. As the Jewish sense of self-worth and self-respect was undermined, so we began to think of the Goyim as superior, their culture as something worthy of emulation or aspiration. We began to feel greater like distress. It was more painful to us over time, their persecution. And we craved the desire, we craved going in their ways, following their ways. Now, this of course goes together with the enlightenment, with the emancipation, with the opportunities. But here's the bitter irony. As the Jewish people were given more civic rights, so to speak, our own sense of self-worth was undermined and deteriorated, because we felt as if we are grateful for the opportunities that are now being dangled before us. Of course, at what cost? But he's speaking here not so much about the abandonment of the mitzvahs that went with it, but rather the more subtle, the internal sense of the loss of self-respect. And he says that Naselana Kashebiosilisbol Olgalusam, and the burden of exile became more and more onerous. There were those who thought, actually, this is good, because now the Jewish people have a more respectable position, and we are able to pursue job or employment opportunities that were closed to us previously. He says, and the result is that they began to think of the earlier generations as if they are like, inferior. They look like the early generations as if they were, you know, nebuchs. They didn't have an education, and they were primitive, they were unsophisticated, and now we have these opportunities, so we're in a better position. He says, Aval ha'emes legamre lehefech. Harishonim hayu gedoli ruach ma'o. The earlier generations were people of spiritual stature. Lo higiru lilibam klal ta'alule ha'ovim hashvalim. And they'd never internalized the reproaches of their enemies. Rak achrei sheshafalnu anu. But when we fell, then in our own eyes, they became more prominent. They became more deserving of emulation or admiration. Vas shafalnu od yoser. And there, and as a result, we felt even less about ourselves. It was a kind of cycle, a spiral. That's right, a downward spiral. Lechushes ol ha'golus be'ein merapech chas v'shalom. Until we felt that this exile is so bitter, it's insufferable, because we are inferior, they are superior, and we're craving to follow their ways and to be like them and to win their acceptance. Zebidiuk, and here's the punchline insofar as our parsha is concerned. Zebidu kamamar hakasuv, says Rav Dassler, this is what the pasuk says. Vanehi be'einein kechagavim, because we lost our own self-respect. We thought of ourselves as inferior and insignificant. V'az ra'inu ki ken hayun be'einehem. So Rav Dassler suggests that in this turn of phrase of the Meraglim, we find like it encapsulates that process by which, if a person, he's talking about Yidden, obviously feels inferior, feels inadequate, feels somehow that others are greater or more worthy or more deserving or more powerful than he, then it actually causes them to feel that way. So according to Rav Dassler, this is a kind of Freudian slip. He doesn't use that expression, that when the Meraglim said, you know, a Freudian slip is when a person inadvertently reveals that which was in his heart, which he may not even realize himself. It's called a Freudian slip. And that's, what, again, without using the turn of phrase, but that's, I think, what Rav Dassler means, that when they said, Vahini be'einir k'chagavim, what they really meant to say was that they, the Kananim, because they're so great and powerful, thought of us as chagavim. That's what they meant to say. But the reason they imagined that about themselves is because they thought themselves to be inferior. That's what Rav Dassler says, is the paradigm. It's interesting. I mean, I'm here to talk some words of Torah, but I do have an interest in Jewish history as well. And when I studied for my master's degree in Jewish history, I read a certain book. My research was especially in the area of reform and counter-reform and Judaism in the modern era. And a certain contemporary scholar wrote a book called The Origins of the Modern Jew, Jewish Identity and European Culture in Germany during certain years. And a lot of that book deals with the pivotal figure in that process of the modernization of Judaism, the one who was the forerunner, really, in an inadvertent way, of the Reform Movement, and that is Moses Mendelssohn. I shouldn't mention his name here, but okay, I already have. That's on the table. What can you do? By the way, he had smicha from Rabbi Yaakov Emdin. Rabbi Yaakov Emdin gave him haskama. He wasn't a Talmud of his, but he went to see him and he interviewed him. He said, "Yeah, you're a pretty good guy." He was actually very learned, Mendelssohn. He was a complex personality, and he is remembered for a lot of things, but he wrote a commentary on the Torah called, known as a Biur, Mendelssohn's Biur. He really was the editor-in-chief. He had a whole editorial staff. And the commentary itself actually is very traditional. When you read it, it's difficult to find anything which is objectionable in it. The style, and there are some features which the Chachamim were not happy with. But the real reason they were not happy is the reason that Mendelssohn did not reveal publicly, but he revealed it in a letter to a friend. Because the Biur of Mendelssohn, the commentary is a fairly traditional comment. Again, it deals with a lot of grammar, and it's stylistically, it's not what we're accustomed to. But in terms of the content, it's really not that objectionable. But the point of it was he published it with a German translation. That is what was objectionable. And he said, yeah, what's wrong with a German translation? You know, you make it accessible to a wider readership. So
Hirsch also wrote in German.
Hirsch also wrote in German, but that was a generation later. About two generations later. And by then, the damage had been done. So Hirsch, as you say, wrote in German. But Mendelssohn was the one who...
Arabic,
yeah. Okay, now that's an interesting thing. So the Ram, of course, wrote in Arabic. All of the Chachamim in the Anshe, the Chachamim Sfad wrote in Arabic for the most part. We find a translation to Arabic as well, by the way. The Sadia Gaon Arabic translation, the Yemenites still use it to this day. It's like a Targum Onkelos for them. So we do find the idea of translation. But without getting too picayune, there's a difference between German and Yiddish. By which I mean, to translate it into Yiddish, that's Ifritaych. That's been around for a long time. But Mendelssohn wanted to teach the Jews a pure German, a literary German. And that motivation is revealed in the following little passage. The truest expression of Mendelssohn's motivation is unquestionably his letter of a certain date, 1779, to his Christian friend, the Dutch state councillor, the name is not important. He writes that his illness has largely incapacitated him from philosophy, but this is what he wrote in the letter. After some examination, I found that the remainder of my powers could still suffice to render a good service to my children and perhaps to a considerable part of my nation if I were to put in their hands a better translation and explanation of the holy books than they had heretofore. This is the first step to culture, something from which my nation sadly is kept at such remove that one might almost despair of the possibility of an improvement. So Mendelssohn has revealed in this letter what he didn't say publicly, certainly not to the rabbis, is that his intention was to teach the Jews, and especially the children, German. He wanted to serve as an entree into the glories of German culture. And if that's the case, we can understand well why the Rabbanim opposed him. But he goes on, the author of this book, he goes on, he says, the Judeo-German jargon, which is Yiddish, symbolized for Mendelssohn, as for the generation of Maskilim who followed him, that foreignness and illegitimacy, which is the sad mark of the pariah. And he wrote elsewhere, I feel that this Yiddish jargon has contributed not a little to the immorality of the common man, and I expect a very good effect from the increasing use of the pure German idiom. So Michael Meyer is the author of this book, a contemporary scholar, not Frum, by the way. He writes about a very keen insight, which, if I may say, is exactly what Rav Dessler has taught us. Psychologically, there seems to be a trace of self-hate or simple shame in Mendelssohn's strange reasonings. Ideologically, the old speech represented for him the past, which must be overcome, and the very counterpole of the culture, which must be achieved. Mendelssohn and his circle essentially internalized the anti-Semitic caricature of the Jew. As Rav Dessler says, whereas for centuries, we never believed for a moment the canards and the taunts of our enemies. We never believed for a moment any of their completely irrational contentions about, I don't even want to review it, but I'll just give you one example. Everyone here is familiar with the phenomenon of the blood libel. Was there ever a Jew? I mean, there probably was at some time in history, but how bizarre it would be for any Jew, however uneducated and however assimilated even, to believe there could be any validity to the notion that Jewish people murder Christian children and use the blood to bake matzah. The proposition is so absurd, it's hard to imagine that any Jew would ever believe such a thing. And yet our enemies believed it. But the Yidden understood, if that's the kind of bizarre, outrageous, completely irrational, monstrous allegation that they say about us, well, that shows that the rest of their contentions are equally meaningless and have no value at all. And therefore, as Rav Dessler says, the Jews never internalized the anti-Semitic caricature. But Mendelssohn and his circle, and Rav Dessler explains why. It's because of simplified in that way. There's a parable, which is perhaps apocryphal, a parable of in the old days, meaning what Rav Dessler says in the Doros HaRishonim, when there was a Yid who was Balagala, or he had a wagon, he was taking his wares to market, and he had his boy sitting next to him, and he had a horse, and they were going along the way, and they got to a crossroads, and then they had to stop because there was a big procession because the Poritz was coming with his carriage, with his outriders, and the whole thing, so they had to sit and wait. So the Yid is saying to his son, you know what, Yemitz Hashem, you'll go to Cheder, and you'll learn Chumash, and you'll learn Rashi, and you'll learn Gemara, and Yemitz Hashem, you'll learn Tosfos, and you'll be a Talmid Chacham, a full person of your Shemayim, and he's describing to him and encouraging him, and he says, then he looks up and he sees this Paritz, and if Chas V'Shalom, you don't, you might, heaven forbid, turn out like that Paritz. So you might imagine that the poor market trader with his scrawny horse would covet the prestige and the wealth and the pomp and the affluence of the Poritz with all of his outriders and all of his horsemen and all of that. But that wasn't the case. For the Jews, I'm not saying that they delighted in their poverty, I'm sure they didn't. But the notion, the possibility of trading places with the Poritz was completely unappealing. For Mendelssohn and his circle, unfortunately, that was no longer the case. I'm already digging myself a bit of a hole with Mendelssohn, I'll tell you about a film which I once saw. Where's Josh? You can strike this on the record this year if you want. But I don't see that. There was a play, I never saw, called the Shana Madel. Okay, with such a name, you might think a rabbi should never be going to see it. Anyway, I didn't go to it. But a few years later, they made a movie called Miss Rose White. It's completely chaste, by the way. And someone said, I didn't go to see it, but anyway, they brought it to me. So the story is of two girls, Polish girls, Jewish girls, cousins. And one of them comes to America in the 1930s, maybe the mid-1930s, makes her way to America, and the other one is left behind in Poland, and she goes through the dark years of the Holocaust. She survives in whichever way is not important, I can't remember. And in 1946, or something like that, shortly after the war, she comes to America, and her other cousin has been there for 10 years. So, and the cousin, the Americanized cousin, who's now a kind of a glamour girl, so she takes her, younger, impoverished, Polish Holocaust survivor cousin under her wing, maybe with some reluctance. Okay, she wants to help her. So she takes her to the fashion places and to the department stores, you know, to get some clothing and, you know, to learn American ways. And at one point, the Americanized girl says, you know, you've got to try on this dress or something like that. You'll be a different person. So the other girl says to her, why do you always want to be a different person? To me, that little exchange encapsulates this idea that actually the one who'd been in America for 10 years was ashamed of who she was. She was ashamed of being the greener. She was ashamed of her Polish accent. She was ashamed of her Jewish roots, and she was craving the American dream. Whereas the other one, despite what she had endured, the horrors of the Holocaust, but she said, why do you always want to be somebody else? I'm happy with who I am. I'm proud of who I am. That is encapsulated in Vanahi Be'einenu Kechagavim. I'll just end with one last story to redeem myself. You can put this one in the record. This is a well-known story which I once heard from the late Rabbi Dr. Shia Twersky myself. Shia Twersky lived in most of his adult life. He lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Was from Milwaukee originally. Actually, he was originally born in Hornisdyple, but he came to America as a boy. He grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and there's a whole story which is interesting unto itself. And then he became a director of a Gateway Rehabilitation Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh is not that far from where the Pennsylvania Dutch live and the Amish. I don't know if you ever heard of these group. They're very interesting. And anyway, he relates, I must go back a long, long time. He once got on a bus, an intercity bus, and he saw there, I mean, he didn't see, but a woman saw him, and, you know, he dressed in Hasidic levush, always from his earliest time to the end of his life. And even though he was a distinguished psychiatrist and all of that, that's how he dressed. Anyway, a woman came up to him, a Jewish woman, and she said to him, I don't understand why you dress this way. Why can't you adopt the appearance of a modern man? You are casting, inviting anti-Semitism. You're hearkening back to a bygone, forgotten era. So he looked at her and he said, Madam, I'm Amish. So she said, oh, you're Amish, because they're just very similar. Oh, you're Amish. Oh, I didn't realize. I think it's so wonderful that you maintain your traditions and that you uphold the ways of your fathers before you and that you haven't sold out to the American. So he said to her, 1,000 apologies, ma'am, but really I am Jewish. But why is it that when I'm Amish, you praise me, and when I'm Jewish, you berate me? And the answer is, because she is Jewish and it makes her uncomfortable to see someone dressed in that way. This reflects the change. And I would just end by saying that Baruch Hashem, Ach Shedara, and we do have a countercurrent, not only a countercurrent of return, but even a more robust, a more confident, a more forthright, and in some cases, I would say, a more successful and a more hopeful approach, in which we do not, I mean, some do, but I'm saying, speaking for the present Tzibur, that we don't feel like Mendelssohn, that inferiority complex, but on the contrary, we recognize Ashrenu Matov Chelkenu. Thank you very much.
Hi. Was? Two ladies. Hi. Since the Seder is a very rich and wealthy one and has much and many areas for expounding and on Drush, but since the beginning was on Chagovim, so we'll continue on the same score. Yeah, sure, let's do the locust syndrome. But you know that Rashi has got a different take, because Rashi is quoting the Gemara in Sotah, and he says, Rashi says, Shumani, we heard, speaking about them, with reflection to the giants that are there in the country. Oimrim zeluze, the giants are discussing in dialogue, and what are they saying to each other? Nemulim yesh bekerumim. There are ants Notice the change. In the vineyards, Kanushim, like the Lilliput story, you know, a little man walking around and you pick him up. Picture Dike. But Rashi says something which seems to go off from the etzem pirush of the Pusik. The Pusik doesn't describe them as ants. The Gemara does. So, like the speaker, Rabbi Rashi said, was resetting what the Kotzke Rebbe encapsulated in one line, and he just said, which essentially means that if you feel like a doormat, people will walk all over you, which is the whole Torah essentially in one line. And the second line, the Kotzke Rebbe said, that another occasion was, Meide, die halst du bist das Schmatte, aber wie weißt du, was jener halt? In other words, you yourself think of yourself as a little insect, but how do you know what the other guy is thinking of you? Which is again the same thought process. But our question here is the difference between Nemulim and Chaguvim. Now remember that it was the giants that say they would like Nemulim. Shloima Melech, in his infant wisdom, used to refer to the ant in a very specific way. He told us, Lech el Nemulu irai. Go and observe the ant and see. B'chakayim, you become clever. You watch him, you see this little ant goes to the anthill, thousands of them. And they come and they drag little crumbs which are five times bigger than them, make this huge heap there. And you think to yourself, how can he eat it? It'll take him about a year to get to the one crumb. Imagine this huge heap. But the ant is a communal creature. Not only that, you know, they're very honest that if somebody eats a crumb that doesn't belong to them, they've got a sense of scent and they can recognize that it's been stolen or taken and eaten, and they all clamp on top of the one ant and they machen them fertig und dann warum ein Skada viskada shmai ant. Yeah? But the Masse, that we're speaking about the Nakida of the quantities that the ant is dragging backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and again, only to create this huge mound of crumbs or whatever it is that they would eat. And you ask yourself, why are you doing so? You live 1,000 years, you'll never be able to eat it. Yeah, machst du Kinder mit Einigkeit, mit Eidemes, mit. Yeah, so therefore you've got to look after them, and you see, you do things not only for yourself, but they're communal creatures. The locust is a completely different nature, because he comes with millions of locusts till the skyline of Mitzrayim was black. They're starving. They land on the victim's land and they eat and eat and eat and eat till Adashi Yaitzema Abrem. And then when they're absolutely full and they've made the ruinous a mess of the country that they've been in, then they pick themselves up, and they've look for the next place. What's the difference? One is altruistic, one is a giving creature, one is a communal creature, and one is a purely egotistical, egocentrical creature who is only in it for himself, efrest, until his mama is still here, and then he moves on to the next address. It's a chmoyrudik. The Beraglim took fruits which were miles bigger than them. According to the Gemara, which Rashi brings there, they had to have, I don't know how many people, 8 people to carry just a bunch of grapes. And the one person to carry a pomegranate, one person to carry a ta'ainu. They were monstrous sized fruits. So why are you taking, look, the Lilliput men are being observed by the giants and they're looking at them and saying, why are you taking this huge fruit? You couldn't possibly eat it. It take you till Elef Hashishi to finish this. So he says, but because they thought that they're like Nemulim. And Nemulim are busy thinking about the others. So there must be some other more little men like them. And in the communion that they've got together, they are looking for a way to feed the rest of them. So Memaila, the giants observed them like Nemulim. But they themselves didn't know what the giants were thinking. They knew their, like Reb Rashi said, their own self-perception. And they recognized that we are in it for ourselves, that the real reason that we came to this land is because like the infamous Chaver Knesset, who would never pick himself up from his chair only for the cleaning lady because he's scared that somebody else might take his seat, right? So Memaila, they too, Lehavdil, used to go to think about the fact that if we leave this midbar, what's the chances of us coming back and reclaiming our killer Manushi Mushi B'nai Yisrael Haimu? That's it. You come to Eretz Yisrael, you'll become an agriculturalist, a farmer. That's the end of the day for you. We need to stay here. That's a purely egocentrical approach. I'm in this for me. I have to defame this land in order to make sure I stay exactly where I am. That is the Chogov syndrome, not the Nomol syndrome. The distinction and the disparity between the ant and the locust. So Meile Rashi explores from the Gemur's perspective that they were the Mulem, and the Meraglim themselves knew the truth. And therefore they said, we really knew the truth, that we are in fact locusts. We're in it for self-gratification. But they thought of us in the same way. They didn't think of you like that. They thought of you like the moon. Which brings us to the end. No, I know. I'll just tell you one quick master. The end of the story of this week's Seder is a master of the Klosenberg Rebbe. We finished the Seder with tzitzis, and I'll tell you something which is a Moyodike master. The end of the Second World War, the Heilige Klosenberg Rebbe looked for an opportunity, we heist us, where he could use the powers of Eisenhower and to bring Chachevtze the Kedisha to the people who were survivors. And apparently, there was, he asked him, what can I do for you, Rabbi? He saw Nebuch, he's a Zerbrochen, a survivor. He says, you know what you can do for me? I need Leluvim and Esrogim for Sikkes, which is coming up soon, but that'll take a bit longer. But with immediacy, I need as many pairs of tzitzis that you can get your hands on. And lo and behold, they arranged it to Italy, whatever it was. They managed to get hold of I think it was six pairs of tzitzis. And they came back to the DP camps where the people were there, and the Klosenberg Rebbe had the tzitzis, and came to Meid. It was a Gerachuset called Pshitrik, his name was Pshitrik, because I know he's the grandson of this person. And Pshitrik came to him and says, Rebbe, ich will my tzitzis! And he was mamish desperate, gone through Shiva Madire Gehenem, and all he could think about was the glee and the happiness he would have to put on a pair of tzitzis. So the Rebbe says, Hemerzi, there's only six pairs here, and we have to be fair. So the fellow went, and he had his concentration camp shirt on. He took his shirt, and he ripped his shirt up till here. He says, Jetzt, Rebbe, bin ich b'mchiv in la teure. Aber kampfes. Look. The Rebbe smiled. Had such a nur from the seal snafish of the person. He says to him, you know what? Et mach a geurl. We put it into lots. If it's meid for you to get, Eibstedt helfen, we'll see. And they made lots, and there were a number of other people there who were all vying for this pair of tzitzis. And who got the first lot? Mr. Pshitrik. Klosenberg Rebbe says, Uchai Noida Duva, person who was doch azam, mean gehenem, has still got the Messias Nefesh to be able to want to pay up for tzitzis. Al kamfai vik daimlet er roysom, so Eibstedt helfen, as der Schrissel in Bashtag.
Cancellation from that's a house, he might.